For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. Today is December the 1st. It is the fifth night of Hanukkah. And we are on page 430. So we are on page 430 in Parshas Mishpatim. It is, as I said, December the 1st. And we are up to Pasuk Chaf Dal, verse 24. Im kesef talva et ami, if you shall lend money to my nation, es ha'ani imach, to the poor one among you, lo siya lo kinoshe, you shall not be to him as a creditor, as it says in English, lo sisimun alav neshech, you shall not put upon him any interest. There are two different prohibitions being stated over here, and there is also a commandment. The commandment is to lend money, that one must lend money. It's here, it doesn't say it as a commandment, but later on in the Chumash it does say as a commandment that there's a requirement to lend money. Here, rather than being this being the source of the commandment, it is the source of the nature of the commandment, which is that when we lend money, there is a hierarchy. If two people come to your door to borrow money at the same time, so if one is from your nation and one is not from your nation, one is a Jew and one is not a Jew, and you only have enough money to lend to one of them, the Torah tells us, "Es ha'ani imach," the poor person with you, lend to the one of your nation first. If you only have enough money for one loan, lend it to the Jew first. That's number one. Number two, let's say you have two Jews who come to your door. One is poor and one is wealthy. It's very common for a wealthy person to need a loan because they might need some cash flow. All their money is tied up in this, that, or the other thing. They need some cash flow, so they come to borrow money. But there's also a poor person who's there to borrow money. So the requirement is to lend the money to the poor person first. If you only have enough money for one loan, lend it to the poor person rather than to the rich person. He takes preference over the rich person.
So if it's a rich Jew and a poor non-Jew,
the Jew still takes preference. Yeah, the Jew always takes preference, and then the poor Jew takes preference over the rich Jew. So those are explaining the nature of the commandment. Then there's two prohibitions in this verse. First of all, lo siya lo kinoshe, do not be to him as a creditor. This means that when the loan is due, so you made a term for the loan, that the loan would be, let's say, 30 days. 30 days are up, and now you come to collect the loan. If you know that the borrower does not have the money to pay you back, then it is prohibited to ask for the money. That is what it means. Lo siya lo kinoshe, do not be to him as a creditor. This is not just a nice thing. It is actually a prohibition. It's a sin to go to the person that you know does not have the money to pay back and demand the loan, even though the loan has come due. It's time to pay. But if you know for a fact they do not have the money, you are prohibited from asking for the money back. You have to wait until such time that you think they're able to procure the money. Now, if you don't know, you're allowed to ask. But if you know for certain they don't have, either one is prohibited from asking for the money. That is the first prohibition in this pasuk, lo siya lo kinoshe, do not be to him as a creditor. That's number one. Number two, lo sisimun alav neshech, do not place upon him interest. This is one of the places in the Torah where we find the prohibition from charging interest to a fellow Jew. To a non-Jew, you're allowed to charge interest, and you're allowed to pay interest to a non-Jew as well. But to a Jew, you're neither allowed to charge interest nor allowed to pay interest. And this is, as I said, one of the places in the Torah where it says that there are other places as well where the Torah emphasizes that one is not allowed to borrow or lend to a non-Jew or from a Jew with interest. Now, if you think about it, this changes the dynamics of the financial system. We, in the United States of America, the truth is, in the worldwide system of commerce, we are used to a system that involves interest. It is commonplace, and that's the normal way things work. And therefore, the holding on to money is a way of making more money because we believe in interest. You can always invest the money and make money. Therefore, for example, if I owe you money, so if I'm a business person, I'm going to try to pay you as late as I possibly can, because the longer I hold on to my money, the longer I can invest in and make money out of that money. Similarly, if you owe me money, I'm going to want it back as soon as possible. That's not the case. If you owe me money, if you owe me money as a loan, I am going to want you to pay me back later because you'll end up paying me more interest, unless I can invest the money for a greater return in another place, in which case I'm going to want my money back. So there is this, the interest plays a very, very big role in how money is handled in our society. When there is no ability to charge interest, at least not to a fellow Jew, it completely changes how things work. Today, when someone wants to start a business, or if a business needs capital, what they do is they go to a bank and borrow money. That's worthwhile for the bank, because the bank is going to charge interest. So if you feel that you have a business venture which can pay 10% return on the money that you sink into the business, you'll go and borrow money with a 5% interest rate, and the bank will make money and you'll make money. That's the way we'll do it. However, if you cannot borrow with interest, then it discourages business loans, because why would anybody lend that kind of money? It's way too much money. It's one thing if you come to me and you say you need money because you need to put food on your table, I might have to lend you money. Or if you come to me because you're running into a cash flow issue with paying some of your employees, you might need some money, I'll lend you money. But you want to start a business and it's going to cost you $1 million to start it up, why would I lend you the money to start up a $1 million business? That's too much money for me to lend out when there's no return for me. What that encourages, rather than borrowing, is partnership. When you can't borrow with interest, then the system that then rises to the top as being the preferred method when you need a lot of money for capital is partnership. That rather than borrowing money, you end up having a group of people get together and jointly start a business. That's what becomes the standard, instead of one person starting a business borrowing money from investors. That becomes the standard practice. Okay, you know, even we permit borrowing and lending to non-Jews with interest. And that system is acceptable in that manner. Now, in theory, one does have to be careful about this. First of all, amongst ourselves, if you ever do get involved in lending money to a Jew, you do have to be careful with this. It can become problematic because the IRS does not recognize loans that do not charge interest. As far as the IRS is concerned, there's no such thing as a loan without interest. It doesn't exist. An interest-free loan, it doesn't exist in their lexicon. It doesn't happen. Therefore, they will charge, they will presume interest has been charged. And so, for example, let's say a business is buying out a partner. A partner is retiring, and a business is buying out the partner. So if the business is worth $1 million, and there's two partners in the business, and one is retiring, so then that retiring partner is owed $500,000 from the business. Mm-hmm. Well, most businesses don't have $500,000 on hand to simply pay out in one lump sum. So most of the time, a business will pay out over time, that there'll be whatever it is over a number of years, a monthly payout, that the business will pay out this partner so that the one partner will buy out the other partner. There is a presumption that interest will be charged because there's a $500,000 loan, essentially, that the partner that's being bought out is lending to the business. So as the business is paying him out over a series of years, there should be an interest rate. Even if the business doesn't pay that interest, the IRS will charge the partner for taxes on that interest, presuming that he was paid that interest. Mm-hmm. Because there's no such thing in the IRS lexicon of an interest-free loan. Mm-hmm. So if you have two Jews who are partners in a business and one is buying out the other, well, you can't charge interest. Nevertheless, the IRS will tax the partner that's being bought out for the interest rate that he should be paid for the loan. So it means that even though we try not to do it, but we are in a system that it's very difficult not to charge interest. We end up getting stuck in situations that do end up forcing us to charge interest. More than that, sometimes you have a situation where one Jew is observant, the other one is not, mm-hmm. and the one who's not observant is not following these laws, mm-hmm. and therefore has no reason not to charge interest or pay interest. It can happen with a mortgage payment, and it can happen with other types of loans as well. And that is where we have the system of heter iska that has been put in place by the rabbinic sages throughout the centuries, came up with a loophole for a way to work it in to a business loan that would charge interest. It doesn't really charge interest. In other words, on paper, it doesn't say it's charging interest, but the net result is that the one who is lending the money ends up getting back more money than they lent. It is a loophole. You'll ask, is it kind of playing games? Yes, it is kind of playing games, but the reason why it was instituted was because there was no way for Jews to survive in the business world in an economy that is so dependent on interest. And so there is a loophole. This loophole is a real loophole. It does work. It's not like there's a sin being committed, but we're kind of like closing our eyes to it. No, there is a loophole that's being employed. It's not so complicated. We could explain it if we needed to, but it's a method of getting around the problem of interest. It is better if a person doesn't need to resort to that. It is best between Jews if we lend and borrow without interest. But if need be, especially in a business setting where we're stuck because of the society around us, there is this method called a heter iska, which can be used. You need to consult with your local rabbi to do it, or local based in. It does require some expertise in the laws of interest and the laws of finance in halacha in the Torah. The concept of a corporation is a very modern concept, and a corporation means that legally there is no individual who is involved. There is this entity called a corporation of which no individual is considered to be the owner of it. There are people who run it, who belong to it, but it is a separate entity that's created, and it's treated that way legally. So the various halachic authorities discuss whether a corporation, is, since it is not an individual, is therefore absolved from these requirements and therefore could borrow and lend with interest. And depending on the type of loan, sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends on what's going on. But you're right, that does create a loophole as well. Besides heter iska, this is a different type of loophole which could happen because of this concept of the corporation, which if you think about it is an interesting type of concept which was created, which is the whole idea is a funny kind of idea that it's something that people are part of, but it's not a person. It's this entity. Chaf Hey 25. Im chavol tachbol salmasrei echa, if you take the clothing of your friend as collateral, Ad bo hashemesh tishivenu lo, until the sun sets, you shall return it to him. There are two types of collateral that are stated in the Torah. There are two types of instances for collateral. Collateral is something which I take in order to ensure that I get paid. So if I lend money and I'm afraid the person is not going to pay me back, so I take an item as collateral. That means that, let's say the person has an expensive item that they don't want to pawn. They could have pawned the money. Let's say they have a gold watch. And they could pawn the gold watch for $1,000, but they don't want to do that. They'd rather borrow $1,000 and pay it back. But I take the gold watch as collateral so that in the event that they don't pay me back, I'm guaranteed at least I have the gold watch. So they give me the collateral, and that guarantees that I'll at least have something. Then when they pay me back, I give them back the gold watch. That's what a collateral is. Their collateral can be taken at the time of the loan. That means when I lend the money, I say to the person, listen, I'm uncomfortable lending the money without collateral because I'm afraid you may not be able to pay me back. I'm only willing to lend the money if you give me collateral. And the person says, fine, and they give me their gold watch. That's one type of collateral. The other type of collateral is that I lend the money without any guarantee. I lend $1,000 for 30 days. 30 days are up. I come to collect the money. They don't have the money. So I take an item in lieu of payment until they're able to pay me. So at that point, I come and I take the collateral. I say, okay, if you can't pay me, I'd like to have that gold watch until you're able to pay me back in full. And the court may require the person to give me something in lieu of payment because they do owe me the money and they do have something. It's not like the previous case where they don't have anything to pay me with. They do, just they don't want to pawn it. Okay, that's acceptable that they don't want to pawn it, but they can't argue they don't have any money. So in that case, they have to give me the item until such time that they can pay me in cash. Fine. That's another type of collateral.
What if they refuse?
That's up to the court what to do in that case. Now, the Torah here is referring to the collateral that is collected at the time of payment, not the collateral that is collected at the time of the loan. A collateral that's collected at the time of the loan is not bound by the law that we're about to talk about. The law we're about to talk about is talking about a collateral that is collected at the time of payment. The person should have paid me already. They couldn't pay me. They didn't have cash. But they did have an item. In this case, the Torah's case is they had clothing. And I took their clothing as collateral. The halacha is that if I take the person's clothing and it is the only set suit the person has, they need to wear it during the day, I may come and take the suit as collateral at night when they get into their pajamas. I can take their suit as collateral. Then in the morning when they need to get dressed to go to shul, I have to be there early enough to return the suit to them so that they can get dressed. So I need to keep coming to their house. Every night I come to the house and collect the suit as collateral. Every morning I come back and return the suit early enough for them to get dressed to go to shul in the morning. That's what the Torah is describing over here. Im chavol tachbol samas reyacha. If you take his collateral, meaning collateral at the time of the payment of the loan, you come and take the person's clothing, ad bo hashemesh, until the sun sets, tishivenulo, you need to return it to him. For the time that the sun is up, until the sun sets, you need to return the cloak to them so that they can have clothing to wear outside of the house. So you're required to do this. This is a very tedious thing. This can go on for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And the lender has to constantly come to the house every night and collect this suit, and then in the morning return this suit. Says the Torah, Ki hi chesuso levada, this is his only clothing. Hi simlaso leoro, it is the covering of his flesh. Bamei yishkav, with what will he sleep? This phrase, bamei yishkav, is referring now to a nighttime garment or to a mattress or to a pillow or something like that, which I could also take as collateral. But if it's his only blanket, if it's his only mattress, and I take that as collateral, well, then it's the reverse. I can take it in the morning and I have to return it every night before he goes to sleep. Then I come back in the morning and collect it again. So therefore, because it's all he has to wear during the day, it's all he has to sleep in at night, I must constantly collect it and then return it. And therefore, Hashem says, the Torah says, if you don't do this, if you don't return the object, v'hayaki tzak elai, it will be when he cries out to me, v'shamati, I will listen, kichanun ani, for I am merciful. I will listen. Hashem guarantees that if a lender does not follow this rule and collects the collateral and does not return the collateral, and it's the only thing the person has to wear either during the day or at night, then the Hashem says, when the person cries out to me, I will listen. You don't want to be on the receiving end of that. Not if Hashem guarantees he's going to listen. Now, it's interesting, Hashem says, Ki chanun ani, for I am merciful. I am gracious. I'm compassionate. I will listen. Now, why does it have to say, Ki chanun ani, for I am compassionate? Is this the only place that we know Hashem is compassionate? We know Hashem is compassionate from other places in the Torah. One might have argued over here, there's two sides to every story. I lent him $1,000. He couldn't pay back. So I come to collect my money. He doesn't have the money. So I take collateral. I take his clothing. I take his blanket. So now the Torah is requiring me every day after work, I have to first stop at his house, drop off his blanket. Then in the morning, on my way to work, I have to go to his house and pick up the blanket. That's fairly tedious. Now, who did who a favor?
Mm-hmm.
I lent him the money.
Mm-hmm.
I could very easily argue that this is absolutely unfair. I lent him the money. He can't pay me back. So, okay. So I'm out $1,000 for the time being. So now I need to wait longer than the due date to get paid back. Fine. So we don't charge interest. Okay? So I'm adhering to the law. I'm not charging interest. All I'm trying to do is make sure he pays me. I'm trying to put a little pressure on him to make sure that he pays me back and he doesn't abscond without paying me back. So I come and I take his blanket. So Torah says, give him back the blanket at night. What do you want from me? I was a nice guy. I lent the money and I'm giving him extra time to pay me back. You're making me return the blanket as well? Hashem says, I am compassionate. Don't think that you as the lender deserve compassion. Because you can always reverse it. There's always two sides to the story. I could argue, Hashem, you should be compassionate on me. I got to go and return the blanket every night. I got to pick up the blanket every morning. What a pain in the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Hashem says, no. I'm compassionate. You're mixing up where your compassion belongs. The person who can't pay you is the one who's going to receive the compassion. And therefore, you need to return it. And if you don't, then he will cry out to me and I will listen. Now here we have in this paragraph, we have what I believe is the most powerful Rashi in all of Chumash. And therefore we're going to read this one inside, even though I recognize many of us cannot follow the Hebrew so well. But we need to read this one inside because of the power of this Rashi. I'm going to show you in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it is in Chafein 25.
Mm-hmm.
That means it's in the first column of Rashi, and it is, I'll tell you what number line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7. It's the seventh line. The seventh line, towards the end of the line, it says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I know it's hard to read the Rashi script.
Mm-hmm.
But it says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rashi here is referring to the double language of Chavol Tachbol, if you take as a collateral. It says it with a double phrase. So Rashi says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, Kama Ata Chayev Li, how liable are you to me? Meaning, no one is perfect. How many things have you done wrong to me? V'hari nafshecha ola etzli, your soul comes up to me, kol emesh ve'emesh, every night.
Mm-hmm.
Every night when you go to sleep, your soul comes upstairs to me. V'nosenet din v'cheshben, and it gives a judgment and a reckoning. I judge your soul every night when it comes upstairs. U'mitzchayeves l'fanai, and it comes out that it's liable in front of me. Every night that your soul comes upstairs, do you think that you're perfect? Do you think when your soul comes upstairs to me and it and I give it a judgment, do you think that you come out lily white? I don't think so. There's always things that you've done wrong during the day, every single day. And yet, v'ani machziralach, yet in the morning I return your soul to you. You bring your soul to me every night. I judge it. I find that you're not perfect. And yet I return your soul to you every morning. Af ata. Also you, tul v'hashev, take it, the collateral, and bring it back. Take the collateral and bring it back. If you want to keep that collateral, then you're tempting me not to return your soul to you in the morning.
Yeah, that's scary.
Isn't that scary?
Yeah, powerful.
Isn't that a powerful Rashi?
Yeah.
My hair stands on it every time I read this Rashi. Hashem says, don't think you're so perfect. You're gonna stand on principle and say that it's not fair that when I lent the money and I'm such a nice guy. Hashem says I can also argue the same thing. It's not fair. I give you your soul. You don't treat it properly. So next time you give me your soul back, I'll keep it. Right? It's a very, very powerful, frightening Rashi, but it sends the point home very, very strong, very clearly. Yes.
Why is it set up so that the person that loaned the money gets the blanket, but the person that borrowed the money brings the blanket or the
right.
gets the
right.
gift of the compassion of the loaner.
Right. Here's the issue. You see, if it was just a blanket, in theory you could say that. The thing is that the Torah is talking about clothing. Now, let's talk daytime clothing. So I'm going to take his suit. So I can't. He can't bring me his suit because what's he going to go home in? His pajamas, right? I have to go to his house and take his suit, and then I got to bring him his suit back in the morning, right? And the same thing really goes with the pajamas. Also, even though it's not as bad, but the thing is that we're talking about removing one set of clothing and putting on the other set of clothing. So he only has one until I return to him what he is supposed to have.
Doesn't it have a bigger meaning than that?
It's embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Degrading.
It's degrading. It's embarrassing. The Torah puts the burden on the lender. If you want to take a collateral, it's perfectly fine, but understand that there's a responsibility that comes with it. You need to continually bring it back, take it, bring it back, and take it. Yeah.
Now, if the poor person came to you and asked to borrow $1,000, and if you realize that there's probably no way that he's ever going to be able to pay you back, do you still have to lend him $1,000?
No. So here we get into the question of tzedakah. The Rambam lists various levels of tzedakah. I believe there are 8 levels of tzedakah, meaning that there's different ways of giving tzedakah. Some are better than others. For example, you've probably heard that it is a higher form of tzedakah if the giver does not know who is receiving the money and if the receiver doesn't know who gave the money, which is why there is an advantage to the giving tzedakah through an organization where the organization has collected money from a bunch of donors. So the recipients don't know who the donors are, and the donors don't know who the recipients are. And it's just a middleman or a middlewoman who is just the person who themselves is not involved at all in the giving of the money because it's not their money, and they're the only one who's involved. You know, that's the go-between. So there is an advantage in doing it that way because it preserves everybody's dignity. So the highest form of tzedakah, what's the highest form of tzedakah, is to give someone a job. That, or to find someone a job.
Or teach them a trade.
To make them gainfully employed, or the ability to be gainfully employed, is the highest form of tzedakah, because then they don't need to actually take charity. That's the highest form. It's considered tzedakah. To help a person become gainfully employed is the highest form of tzedakah. In the absence of that, the next highest form of tzedakah is to lend the money and then not collect it. Because there, it's the person preserves their dignity. You lend the money, and you know it's tzedakah as you're giving it, and you've written it off already in your mind, I'm giving it. You don't say that, I mean, if the person somehow gets to pay you back, then you'll take the money back, but in your own mind, you've said to yourself, okay, this is a tzedakah that I'm doing, I'm lending the money, and if it never comes back, it never comes back. That is one of the highest forms of tzedakah because it preserves the recipient's dignity because they're not actually taking a handout, we're calling it a loan.
But then you probably wouldn't go through the exercise of taking his garment.
That's right. That's only if you really want to get paid back.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. Pasuk Chaf Zayin, verse 27. Elokim lo sekalel, do not curse. Now, this could either be Elokim, which is God, or Elohim, which is the judges. As we know, the word Elohim can also mean judges, because Elohim means power. So there's a prohibition to curse the judges, meaning a person went to court and was found liable, comes out of court, is not happy about it, is prohibited from cursing the judges. And one is not, of course, not allowed to curse God. Cursing God is such a bad, is such a terrible sin that in the Gemara, it's not called Kilalas Hashem, cursing God. The Gemara won't even say those words. The Gemara says Birchas Hashem, which means blessing God. Because it doesn't even want to say the words cursing and then God. It's too dangerous to say that. Therefore, the Gemara couches it as Birchas Hashem, blessing God, even though it means the opposite. This is a prohibition for non-Jews as well. Just like a Jew is not allowed to curse God, God forbid. So a non-Jew is also not allowed to do that. And another prohibition, the nasi ve'amchalo sa'or, and the prince or the leader or the king in your nation, you also may not curse. So this is a special prohibition against cursing the leader, which would be the king or the governor, whoever is the person in charge. Then one is not allowed to curse them either. Now, you're not allowed to curse any Jew, but there's an additional prohibition against cursing a judge or cursing the king. Why would the Torah need an extra prohibition for people who are in position of authority?
Because they represent him.
They'd be more likely to come in for this kind of
thing. Yeah. I mean, most people, a lot of people, people who are in positions of authority, by definition, are not going to be popular amongst everybody. That you don't get that. You cannot be in a position of authority responsibly and be everybody's friend. Someone's not going to like you. It's going to have to happen. Therefore, they are much more at risk of being cursed, and therefore the Torah has to emphasize that you're not allowed to curse them. What if the king is, or the leader is, not acting properly? That's why it says v'nasi ve'amcha, in your nation. In your nation means, besides being a Jew, it means someone who's acting like a Jew, which means they're keeping the Torah. If there's a person in position who's abusing his position and not acting properly in his position of authority, then this prohibition is not applicable, and it is permitted to curse that person, or I should say, one is not prohibited from cursing that person. I want to describe to you, with the few minutes we have left, the process for judging a person who is accused of cursing God. It is so bad to do it that it's difficult to even try the case, because when you try a case, you need testimony. So the witnesses say, we saw or heard so-and-so do such-and-such. So if they say, we saw so-and-so violate Shabbos, so then they'll tell us what they saw. We saw so-and-so eat pork, tell us they saw so-and-so eat pork. We saw so-and-so hit so-and-so, or damage so-and-so, or steal money from so-and-so, they'll tell us. But here they need to say, we heard so-and-so curse God. Now, that's not good enough, because it's a technicality. To be liable for cursing God, one has to say it in a very specific way. We're not going to get into tonight what the specific is. It's a Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin that goes through it. But it's a very specific type of phrase. And we need to know that the person actually said those words, which means the witness is going to have to say, I heard so-and-so say, and he's going to have to quote him. Now, we don't want him to quote him, because quoting him is cursing God. Therefore, the Mishnah says, the entire day that the court case is going on, we do not let the witnesses use the name of God that they heard. They heard him use the name of God. They heard him utter the name of God, because to say, I curse God, is not this prohibition. The person has to actually utter the name of God. So we don't let the witnesses do that. We make them use a kinoi, which means a substitute for God's name, like Hashem. Mm-hmm. We make them use a different word. The entire day, as we're trying the case and we're interrogating the witnesses, we use a kinoi, we use a substitute, we use Hashem. But when we finally are finished with everything and we know for certain that the person has done the crime, which means we're going to stone him, we're going to put him to death for it, we need to hear from the witnesses the real phrase. And then the judges, who are seated, judges are always seated, they say to the oldest witness, the chief witness, tell us exactly what you heard. And he says the exact words. He says the exact words. The second witness, because you need two witnesses, does not repeat what the first witness says. The second witness says, I heard the same thing. Because we don't want to repeat the phrase if we don't have to. Mm-hmm. Moreover, when the first witness says, I heard, and he quotes the exact phrase that the defendant actually said, the judges stand up and they tear their clothes. Mm-hmm. They tear kriya, like when someone dies. Mm-hmm. and then they pronounce that the person is now liable for death. That's how bad the sin is. We don't want to hear it. So the entire day they don't even use the phrase until that last moment. And once we know we're going to put him to death, we need to hear it, so then we have him do it. But only one of the witnesses, not both, the other one just says, I heard the same thing, and they tear their garments when they hear it. And that's why the Gemara doesn't use the phrase Kilas and Hashem, cursing and the word God. They don't want to do that. It's blessing Hashem because of the euphemism, because we don't want to actually say the phrase. Yes?
Let's say someone loses a child, and there are all kinds of reactions, you know, terrible anger, terrible anguish. And people might say at that moment, in front of two people, I'm just so-and-so-so. Is that whole the same as that?
So, because of how technical it is, it's unlikely that a person in that situation would say the exact words for which they would be put to death. It's a very, very specific thing. The person would also have to be warned. There has to be warning also. We don't put to death without warning. So there would have to be a situation where a person says, you know, if you say that, you're going to be put to death, and then the person says it anyway. So it's not a simple matter for it to happen. The reason why it's so technical to get the right phrase is because, what is a curse anyway? We're not talking about a profanity. What is a curse? A curse is, for example, I'm talking to this person over here, this evil person. I say, may God bring, you know, calamity upon your head. Right? That's a curse. That's what a curse is. So how do you curse God? Right? Well, how do you do that? So the Mishnah says, you have to, it's a funny thing, but in order for it to be the real prohibition of cursing God, it has to be that one curses God using God, which is a funny thing, right? How does that work? I mean, it's a very funny kind of, so that's what I mean, it's very technical. That's what I mean, it's not likely that a person would do that by accident. Mm-hmm. It would be the person knows what they're doing and does it anyway. It would have to be something like that. Okay, so we will meet again, Mr. Shem, in 2 weeks on the 15th. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.